The villagers would certainly have a surprise next time they all drank from their illegal water hoard. Serves them right. Do you know what this drug will do to them? Jostin asked. Garan shook his head. I've heard plenty of crazy stories. Maybe we should make the kid try it first, the side gunner said. Jostin backed away, raising his hands. Garan looked at the contaminated cistern again. I bet they tear off their clothes and dance naked in the streets, squawking like dinfowl. Let's stay here and watch the fun for ourselves, Keel said. Garan frowned. Do you want to be the one to explain to Rabban why we're late returning from patrol? Let's go, Keel answered quickly. As the worm poison infused the cistern, the Harkonnen troopers hurried back to their ornithopter, reluctantly content to let the villagers discover the prank for themselves. Before us, all methods of learning were tainted by instinct. Before us, instinct-ridden researchers possessed a limited attention span, often no longer than a single lifetime. Projects stretching across 50 or more generations never occurred to them. The concept of total muscle nerve training had not entered their awareness. We learned how to learn. Bene Gesserit, Ajar Book. Is this truly a special child? The Reverend Mother Gaius, Helen Mohiam, watched the perfectly proportioned girl perform Pranabindu muscular nervature exercises on the hardwood floor of the Mother School's training module. Recently returned from the abortive banquet on Arrakis, Mohiam tried to look at her student with impartiality, suppressing the truth. Jessica, my own daughter. The girl must never know her heritage, must never suspect. Even on the secret Bene Gesserit breeding charts, Mohiam was not identified by her sisterhood adopted name, but by her birth name of Tanidia Neris. 12-year-old Jessica stood poised, arms at her sides, trying to relax herself, trying to arrest the movement of every muscle in her body. Gripping an imaginary blade in her right hand, she stared straight ahead at a chimerical opponent. She summoned untapped depths of inner peace and concentration. But Mohiam's sharp eye noted the barely discernible twitches in Jessica's calf muscles, around her neck, over one eyebrow. This one would need more practice in order to perfect the techniques. But the child had made excellent progress and showed great promise. Jessica was blessed with a supreme patience, an ability to calm herself and listen to what she was told. So focused, this one, so full of potential, as she was bred to be. Jessica fainted to the left, floated, whirled, then stiffened to become a sudden statue again. Her eyes, while looking at Mohiam, did not see her taskmistress and mentor. The stern Reverend Mother entered the training module, stared into the girl's clear green eyes, and saw an emptiness there, like the gaze of a corpse. Jessica was gone, lost among her nerve and muscle fibers. Mohiam dampened a finger and placed it in front of the girl's nose. She felt only the faintest stirring of air. The budding breasts on the slender torso barely moved. Jessica was close to a complete bindu suspension. But not quite. Much hard work remains. In the sisterhood, only total perfection was good enough. As Jessica's instructor, Mohiam would go over the ancient routines again and again, reviewing the steps that must be followed. The Reverend Mother pulled back, studying Jessica but not rousing her. In the girl's oval face, She tried to identify her own features, or those of the father, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. The long neck and small nose reflected Mohiam's genetics. But the widow's peak at the hairline, the wide mouth, generous lips, and clear skin derived from the Baron, back when he'd been healthy and attractive. Jessica's widely set green eyes and hair the color of polished bronze came from more distant latencies. If you only knew. Mohiam recalled what she'd been told of the Bene Gesserit plan. Jessica's own daughter, when grown to womanhood, was destined to give birth to the Kwisatz Haderach, the culmination of millennia of careful breeding. Mohiam looked into the girl's face, searching for any twitch, any hint of grand historical import. You are not ready to discover this yet. Jessica began to speak, mouthing word shapes as she recited a mantra as ancient as the Bene Gesserit school itself. Each attacker is a feather drifting on an infinite path. As the feather approaches, it is diverted and removed. My response is a puff of air that blows the feather away. Mohiam stepped back as her daughter snapped into a blur of motion, attempting to float through reflex moves. But Jessica still struggled to force her muscles to flow silently and smoothly, when she should have allowed them to do so. The girl's movements were better than before, more focused and precise. Jessica's recent progress had been impressive, as if she'd experienced a mind-clarifying epiphany that lifted her to the next level. However, Mohiam still detected too much youthful energy and unharnessed intensity. This girl was the product of a vicious rape by Baron Harkonnen, after the sisterhood had blackmailed him into providing them with a daughter. Mohiam had exacted her revenge during the sexual attack, controlling her internal body chemistry in the Bene Gesserit way, inflicting him with a painful, debilitating disease. Such a delightfully slow torture. As his ailment progressed, the Baron had relied on a cane for the past standard year. At the Fenring's banquet, she'd been sorely tempted to tell the gross man what she'd done to him. But if Mohiam had told him, there would have been another act of violence in the dining hall of the residency at Arakeen, far worse than the squabble between the Akazi and Grumman ambassadors. She might even have found it necessary to kill the Baron with her deadly fighting skills. Jessica herself, despite her limited training, could have dispatched the man, her own father, quickly and easily. Hearing a whir of machinery, Mohiam watched a life-size doll emerge from the floor, the next phase of the routine. In a blur, the girl whirled and decapitated it with a single slashing kick. More finesse. The killing touch must be delicate, precise. Yes, Reverend Mother. Still, I am proud of what you have accomplished. Mohiam spoke in an uncharacteristically gentle tone, one that her superiors would not condone, had they heard it. Love, in any form, was prohibited. The sisterhood has great plans for you, Jessica. Shuta is a word that means many things. Every Bene Tlelax knows it was the name of the first master. But just as that man was more than a mere mortal, so there are depths and complexities in the appellation. Depending upon tone and vocal inflection, Shuta can mean hello or blessings be upon you. Or it can constitute a prayer encompassed in a single word, as a devotee prepares to die for the great belief. For such reasons, we have chosen this as our new name for the conquered planet formerly known as Ix. Tlelaxu Training Disc. A contingency plan is only as good as the mind that devises it. Deep in the labyrinthine research pavilion, Haidar Fen Ajitika understood that maxim only too well. One day the Emperor's man would attempt to kill him. Therefore, careful defensive preparations were necessary. "This way, please, Count Fenring," Ajitika said in his most pleasant voice, while thinking, "Unclean Powinda." He glanced peripherally at the man. "I should slay you now." But the master researcher could not accomplish this safely, and might never have the proper opportunity. Even if he did succeed, the Emperor would send in his investigators and even more Sardaukar troops to interfere with the delicate work. "It is good to hear that you are finally making progress on Project Amal. Elrud IX did commission it over a dozen years ago, Fenring strolled along a featureless corridor in the underground city. He wore a scarlet imperial jacket and tight-fitting gold trousers. His dark hair was razor-cut, sticking out in patches to emphasize his overlarge head. "We have been extremely patient." Ajitika wore a white lab coat with ample pockets. Chemical odors clung to the fabric, his hair, his corpse-like gray skin. "I warned all of you in the beginning that it could take many years to develop a completed product. A dozen years is a mere eye-blink to develop a substance the Imperium has wanted for centuries upon centuries." His nostrils narrowed as he forced a thin smile. "Nevertheless, I am pleased to report that our modified axolotl tanks have now been grown, that preliminary experiments have been conducted and the data analyzed. Based on this, we have discarded unworkable solutions, thus narrowing down the remaining possibilities." "The Emperor is not interested in narrowed possibilities, Master Researcher, but in results." Fenring's voice was frozen acid. "Your expenses have been immense, even after we financed your takeover of Ixion facilities." "Our records would stand up to any audit, Count Fenring," Ajitika said. He knew full well that Fenring could never allow a guild banker to look at the expenditures. The Spacing Guild, more than any other entity, must not suspect the aim of this project. "All funds have been properly applied. All spice stockpiles are accounted for, exactly according to our original agreement." "Your agreement was with Elrud, little man, not with Shaddam, The Emperor can stop your experiments at any moment." Like all Tleilaxu, Ajitika was accustomed to being insulted and provoked by fools. He refused to take offense. "An interesting threat, Count Fenring, considering that you personally initiated the contact between my people and Elrud. We have recordings back on the Tleilaxu homeworlds." Fenring bristled and pushed ahead, deeper into the research pavilion. "Just by observing you, Master Researcher, I have learned something," he said in an oily voice. "You have developed a phobia of being underground, The fear came upon you recently, a sudden onslaught." "Nonsense." Despite his denial, sweat broke out on Ajitika's forehead. "Ah, but I detect something mendacious in your voice and expression. You take medication for the condition. A bottle of pills in the right pocket of your jacket. I see the bulge." Trying to conceal his rage, Ajitika stammered, "I am in perfect health." "I would say that your continued health depends upon how well things are going here. The sooner you complete Project Amal, the sooner you will be able to breathe fresh air again back on beautiful Tleilax. When was the last time you were there?" "A long time ago," Ajitika admitted. "You cannot know what it looks like. No Powin," he caught himself. "No outsider has ever been permitted beyond the spaceport." Fenring simply answered with a maddening, too-knowing smile. Just show me what you have done here so that I can report to Shaddam. At a doorway, Ajitika raised his arm to block Fenring's passage. The Tlaloxu closed his eyes and reverently kissed the door. The brief ritual deactivated the deadly security systems, and the door melted into narrow cracks in the wall. "You may enter safely now." Ajitika stepped aside to let Fenring cross into a white, smooth plaz room, where the master researcher had set up a number of demonstrations to show the progress of the experiments. In the center of the enormous oval room sat a high-resolution microscope, a metal rack containing laboratory bottles and vials, and a red table holding a dome-shaped object. Ajitika saw intense interest in Fenring's overlarge eyes as he approached the demonstration area. "Don't touch anything, please." Subtle treacheries hung thick in the air, and this imperial Powinda would never see or comprehend them until it was too late. Ajitika intended to solve the riddle of the artificial spice, then escape with the sacred axolotl tanks to a safe planet in the farthest reaches of the Imperium. He had made a number of clever arrangements without revealing his identity, using promises and bribes, transferring funds, all without the knowledge of his superiors on the Bene Tlaloc's homeworld. He was alone in this. He had decided that there were heretics among his own people, followers who had adopted their identity as downtrodden scapegoats so well that they had forgotten the heart of the great belief. It was like a face dancer who had disguised himself so well he had forgotten who he truly was. If Ajitika meekly allowed such people access to his great discovery of Amal, they would surrender the one thing that would gain them the supremacy they deserved. Ajitika planned to continue in his role until he was ready. And then he could take the artificial spice, control it himself, and help his people and their mission, whether they wanted him to or not. Count Fenring murmured as he leaned close to the dome shape on the table. "Most intriguing. Something is inside, I presume, "Something is inside of everything," Ajitika replied. He smiled inwardly as he imagined a glut of artificial spice flowing into the interplanetary marketplace, wreaking economic havoc within Choam and the Landsraad. Like a tiny leak in a dam, a bit of inexpensive melange would ultimately become a raging torrent to turn the Imperium upside down. If played right, Ajitika would be the kingpin of the new economic and political order. Not to serve himself, of course, but to serve God. "The magic of our God is our salvation." Ajitika smiled at Count Fenring, revealing sharp teeth. "Rest assured, Count Fenring, our goals in this matter are mutual." In time, wealthy beyond imagining, Ajitika would develop tests to determine loyalty to his new regime, and he would begin assimilating the Bene Tlaloc. Though it was too dangerous to bring them into his scheme now, he had several candidates in mind. With proper military support, perhaps even converts among the Sardaukar stationed here, he might even set up headquarters in the lovely capital city of Bandalong. Fenring continued to snoop at the demonstration equipment. "Have you ever heard the saying, 'Trust but verify'? It's from old Terra. You'd be surprised at the little tidbits I pick up. My Bene Gesserit wife collects objects, knick-knacks, and the like. I collect pieces of information." The Tlaloxu's narrow face twisted into a frown. "I see." He needed to finish this annoying inspection as quickly as possible. "If you will look over here, please." Ajitika removed an opaque plas vial from the rack and lifted the lid, letting out a strong odor reminiscent of raw ginger, bergamot, and clove. He passed the container to Fenring, who peered at a thick, orangish substance. "Not quite melange," Adjitika said, "though chemically it has many spice precursors." He poured the syrup on a scanning plate, inserted it into the microscope reader, then beckoned Fenring to look through the eyepiece. The Count saw elongated molecules connected to one another like the strands of a cable. "An unusual protein chain," the master researcher said. "We are close to a breakthrough."
"How close?"
"The Tleilaxu also have sayings, Count Fenring. The closer one gets to a goal, the farther off it appears to be. In matters of scientific research, time has a way of stretching. Only God possesses intimate knowledge of the future. The breakthrough could occur in a matter of days, or years."
"Double talk," Fenring muttered.
He fell silent when Adjitika pressed a button at the base of the dome. The foggy surface of the plaz cleared, revealing sand on the bottom of the container. The Tleilaxu researcher pressed another button, filling the interior with a fine dust. The sand moved, a tiny mound in motion that surfaced, like a fish emerging from murky water. A worm shape, the size of a small snake, it was a little over half a meter in length, with tiny crystal teeth.
"Sandworm, immature form," Adjitika said. 19 days from Arrakis. We don't expect it to survive much longer."
From the top of the dome, a box dropped to the sand on a hidden suspensor, then opened to reveal more of the glistening orange gelatin.
Amal 1522.16, Adjitika said. "One of our many variations. The best we've developed so far."
Fenring watched as the mouth of the immature worm quested left and right, revealing glimmering thorns far back in its gullet. The creature slithered toward the orange substance, then stopped in confusion and didn't touch it. Presently it turned and burrowed back into the sand.
"What is the relationship between the sandworms and the spice?" Fenring asked.
"If we knew that, we would have the puzzle solved. If I were to put real spice in that enclosure, the worm would consume it in a primal frenzy. Still, though the worm can identify the difference, at least it did approach the sample. We tempted the beast, but did not satisfy it."
"Nor did your little demonstration satisfy me. I am told that there continues to be an Ixian underground movement, causing difficulties. Shaddam is concerned about interference with his most important plan."
"A few rebels, Count Fenring. Inadequately funded, with limited resources. Nothing to worry about."
Adjitika rubbed his hands together. "But they have sabotaged your communication systems and destroyed a number of facilities,
"The death throes of House Vernius. No more. It has been well over a decade, and soon it will die down. They cannot get near this research pavilion."
"Well, your security worries are over, Master Researcher. The Emperor has agreed to dispatch 2 additional legions of Sardaukar as peacekeepers, led by Bashar Kando Garon, one of our best."
A look of alarm and surprise came over the diminutive Tleilaxu. His pinched face reddened.
"But that isn't necessary, sir. The half-legion already in place is more than sufficient."
"The Emperor does not agree. These troops will emphasize the importance of your experiments to him. Shaddam will do anything to protect the Amal program, but his patience has run out."
The Count's eyes narrowed. "You should think of this as good news."
"Why is that? I do not understand."
"Because the Emperor has not yet ordered your execution."
A center for the coordination of rebellion can be mobile. It does not need to be a permanent place where people meet. Kamar Pilru, Ixian Ambassador in Exile, Treatise on the Downfall of Unjust Governments. The Tleilaxu invaders had instituted a brutal curfew for anyone not assigned to the late work shift. For Keter Pilru, slipping away to attend the hushed rebellion meetings was just another way to thumb his nose at their restrictions. At the freedom fighters' irregular, carefully guarded gatherings, Keter could finally remove his masks and disguises. He became the person he once had been, the person he remained inside. Knowing he'd be killed if caught, the short, dark-haired man approached the meeting place. He clung to oily night shadows between blocky buildings on the cavern floor, making no sound. The Tleilaxu had restored the projected sky on the cavern ceiling, but they had reconfigured the sparkle of stars to show the constellations over their own homeworlds. Here on Ix, even the heavens were wrong. This was not the glorious place it should be, but a hellish prison beneath the surface of the planet. We will change all that. Someday. During more than a decade of repression, black marketeers and revolutionaries had built their secret network. The scattered resistance groups interacted to exchange supplies, equipment, and information. But each gathering made Keter nervous. If they were caught together, the fledgling rebellion could be snuffed out in a few moments of lasgun fire. When possible, he preferred to work alone, as he had always done. Trusting no one, he never divulged details of his surreptitious life, not even to other rebels. He'd made private contacts with rare off-worlders at the Port of Entry Canyon. Openings and landing pads in the sheer cliff wall where carefully guarded ships hauled Tleilaxu products to waiting highliners in orbit. The Imperium required vital items of Ixian technology, which were now manufactured under Tleilaxu control. The invaders needed the profits to finance their own work, and they could not risk outside scrutiny. Although they could not seal Ix completely away from the rest of the Imperium, the Tleilaxu used the services of very few outsiders. Sometimes, under the direst of circumstances and at great risk to himself, Keter could bribe one of the transport laborers to skim a shipment or snag a vital component. Other black marketeers had their own contacts, but they refused to share that information with each other. It was safer that way. Now, slipping through the claustrophobic night, he passed an abandoned manufactory, turned onto an even darker street, and picked up his pace. The meeting was about to begin. Perhaps tonight. Though it seemed hopeless, Keter continued to find ways to strike against the Tleilaxu slave masters, and other rebels did the same. Infuriated that they could not capture any saboteurs, the masters made examples out of hapless suboids. After torture and mutilation, the scapegoat would be hurled off the Grand Palais balcony to the distant cavern floor, where great highliners had once been built. Every expression on the victim's face, every dripping wound, was projected on the hollow sky, while recorders transmitted his wails and screams. But the Tleilaxu understood little of the Ixian psyche. Their brutality only caused greater unrest and more incidents of violent rebellion. Over the years, Keter could see the Tleilaxu being worn down, despite efforts to crush the resistance with shape-shifting face-dancer infiltrators and surveillance pods. The freedom fighters continued the struggle. Those few rebels with access to uncensored outside news reported on the activities in the Imperium. From them, Keter learned of impassioned speeches before the Landsrad made by his father, the exiled Ixian ambassador. Little more than futile gestures. Earl Dominic Vernius, who'd been overthrown and gone renegade, had vanished completely, and his heir, Prince Romber, lived in exile on Caladan, without a military force and without Landsrad support. The rebels could not count on rescue from the outside. Victory must come from inside, from Ix. He rounded another corner, and in a narrow alleyway stepped onto a metal grating. Narrowing his dark eyes, Kater looked from side to side, always expecting someone to spring out of the shadows. His demeanor was furtive and quick, drastically different from the cowed and cooperative routine he followed in public. He gave the password, and the grate lowered, taking him beneath the street. He hurried down a dark corridor. During the day shift, Kater wore a gray work smock. He had learned how to mimic the simple, lackluster suboids over the years. He walked with a stooped gait, eyes dull with disinterest. He had 15 identity cards, and no one bothered to study faces in the shifting masses of laborers. It was easy to become invisible. The rebels had developed their own identity checks. They posted concealed guards outside the abandoned facility under infrared glow globes. Trans eyes and sonic detectors provided a further bubble of protection, none of which would help if the freedom fighters were discovered. On this level, the guards were visible. When Kater mumbled his password response, they waved him inside. Too easily. He had to tolerate these people and their inept security games in order to acquire the equipment he needed. But he didn't have to feel comfortable about it. Kater scanned the meeting site. At least that had been carefully selected. This closed-down facility had once assembled combat mechs to train fighters against a spectrum of tactics or weapons. But the Tleilaxu overlords had unilaterally determined that such self-aware machines violated the strictures of the Butlerian Jihad. Though all thinking machines had been obliterated 10,000 years before, severe prohibitions were still in effect and emotions ran high. This place, and others like it, had been abandoned after the revolt on Ix, production lines left to fall into disrepair. Some equipment had been cannibalized for other uses, the rest turned into scrap. Other pursuits preoccupied the Tleilaxu. Secret work, a vast project staffed only by their own people. No one, not even members of Kater's resistance group, had been able to determine what the overlords had in mind. Inside the echoing facility, flinty-eyed resistance fighters spoke in whispers. There would be no formal agenda, no leader, no speech. Kater smelled their nervous sweat, heard odd inflections in the low voices. No matter how many security precautions they took, how many escape plans they devised, it was still dangerous to have so many gathered in one place. Kater always kept his eyes open, aware of the nearest exit. He had business to conduct. He'd brought a disguised satchel containing the most vital items he had hoarded. He needed to trade with other scavengers to find components for his innovative but problematic transmitter, the Rogo. The prototype allowed him to communicate through fold space with his twin brother Demur, a guild navigator. But Kater rarely succeeded in establishing contact, either because his twin had mutated so far from human, or because the transmitter itself was falling apart. On a dusty metal table, he brought out weapons components, power sources, communications devices, and scanning equipment. Items that would have led to his immediate execution if any Tleilaxu had stopped to ask his business. But Kater armed himself well, and he had killed the gnomish men before. Kater displayed his wares. He searched the faces of the rebels, the crude disguises and intentional dirt smudges, until he spotted a woman with large eyes, prominent cheekbones, and a narrow chin. Her hair had been raggedly chopped in an effort to destroy any hint of beauty. He knew her as Miral Alekum, though that might not have been her real name. In her face, Kater saw echoes of Kylea Vernius, the pretty daughter of Earl Vernius. He and his twin brother had both fancied Kylea, flirted with her, back when they'd thought nothing would ever change. Now Kylea was exiled on Caladan, and Demur was a guild navigator. The twins' mother, a guild banker, had been killed during the takeover of Ix, and Kater himself lived like a furtive rat, flitting from hideout to hideout. "I found the crystal pack you requested," he said to Miral. She withdrew a wrapped item from a sack at her waist. "I've got the module rods you needed, calibrated precisely. I hope. I had no way of checking." Kater took the packet, feeling no need to inspect the merchandise. "I can do it myself." He handed Miral the crystal pack, but did not ask what she had in mind for it. Everyone present searched for ways to strike against the Tleilaxu. Nothing else mattered. As he exchanged a nervous glance with her, he wondered if she might be thinking the same thing he was, that under different circumstances they might have had a personal relationship. But he couldn't allow her that close to him. Not anyone. It would weaken him and divert his resolve. He had to remain focused, for the sake of the Ixian cause. One of the door guards hissed an alarm, and everyone fell into fearful silence, ducking low. The muted glow globes dimmed. Kater held his breath. A humming sound passed overhead as a surveillance pod cruised above the abandoned buildings, trying to pick up unauthorized vibrations or movements. Shadows smothered the hiding rebels. Kater mentally reviewed the location of every possible escape from this facility, in case he needed to duck out into the blinding darkness. But the humming device cruised onward down the length of the city grotto. Shortly afterward, the nervous rebels stood again and began muttering to themselves, wiping sweat off their faces, laughing nervously. Spooked, Kater decided not to remain any longer. He memorized the coordinates for the group's next gathering, packed up his remaining equipment, and looked around, scanning the faces once more, marking them in his mind. If they were caught, he might never see these people again. He nodded a final time at Miral Alekum, then slipped off into the Ixian night, flitting under artificial stars. He had already made up his mind where he would spend the remainder of the sleep shift, and which identity he would choose for the following day. It is said that the Freeman has no conscience, having lost it in a burning desire for revenge. This is foolish. Only the rawest primitive and the sociopath have no conscience. The Freeman possesses a highly evolved worldview centered on the welfare of his people. His sense of belonging to the community is almost stronger than his sense of self. It is only to outsiders that these desert dwellers seem brutish, just as outsiders appear to them. Pardit Kynes, The People of Arrakis. "Luxury is for the noble-born, Leet," Pardit Kynes said, as the ground car trundled across the uneven ground. Here, in privacy, he could use his son's secret Siege name, rather than Weichi, the name reserved for outsiders. On this planet you must instantly become aware of your own surroundings and remain alert at all times. If you fail to learn this lesson, you won't live long. As Kynes operated the simple controls, he gestured toward the buttery morning light that melted across the stark dunes.
There are rewards here, too. I grew up on Seleucia Secundus, and even that broken and wounded place had its beauty, though nothing to match the purity of Dune.
Kynes exhaled a long breath between his hard, chapped lips. Leet continued to stare out the scratched window plaz. Unlike his father, who reeled off whatever random thoughts occurred to him, making pronouncements that the freeman heeded as if they were weighty spiritual matters, Leet preferred silence. He narrowed his eyes to study the landscape, searching for any small thing out of its place. Always alert. On such a harsh planet, one had to develop stored perceptions, each of them linked to every moment of survival. Though his father was much older, Leet wasn't certain the planetologist understood as much as he himself did. The mind of Pardut Kynes contained powerful concepts, but the older man experienced them only as esoteric data. He didn't understand the desert in his heart or in his soul. For years, Kynes had lived among the freemen. It was said that Emperor Shaddam IV had little interest in his activities, and since Kynes asked for no funding and few supplies, they left him alone. With each passing year, he slipped farther from attention. Shaddam and his advisors had stopped expecting any grand revelations from the planetologist's periodic reports. This suited Pardut Kynes, and his son as well. In his wanderings, Kynes often made trips to outlying villages where the people of the Pan and Graben scratched out squalid lives. True freemen rarely mixed with the townspeople, and viewed them with veiled contempt for being too soft, too civilized. Leet would never have lived in those pathetic settlements for all the Solaris in the Imperium. But still, Pardut visited them. Eschewing roads and commonly traveled paths, they rode in the ground car, checking meteorological stations and collecting data, though Pardut's troops of devoted freemen would gladly have done this menial work for their Oma. Leet Kynes's features echoed many of his father's, though with a leaner face and the closely set eyes of his freeman mother. He had pale hair, and his chin was still smooth, though later he would likely grow a beard similar to the great planetologist's. Leet's eyes had the deep blue of spice addiction, since every meal and breath of sea air was laced with melange. Leet heard a sharp intake of breath from his father as they passed the jagged elbow of a canyon where camouflaged catch traps directed moisture to plantings of rabbit bush and poverty grasses. "See, it's taking on a life of its own. We'll cycle the planet through prairie phase into forest over several generations. The sand has a high salt content, indicating old oceans, and the spice itself is alkaline." He chuckled. "People in the Imperium would be horrified that we'd use spice byproducts for something as menial as fertilizer." He smiled at his son. "But we know the value of such things, eh? If we break down the spice, we can set up protein digestion. Even now, if we flew high enough, we could spot patches of green where matted plant growth holds the dune faces in place." The young man sighed. His father was a great man with magnificent dreams for Dune. And yet Kynes was so focused on one thing that he failed to see the universe around him. Leet knew that if any Harkonnen patrols found the plantings, they would destroy them and punish the freemen. Though only 12, Leet went out on Razzia raids with his freeman brothers and had already killed Harkonnens.